This Monday, as the announcement of indictments against Trump campaign operatives shook Washington, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly took to Fox News to calm the waters by fanning the flames of long-debunked Civil War narratives.
Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. The lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War. And men and women of good faith on both sides made their stand where their conscience had them make their stand.
Oh, really? The history of American slavery was all about compromise, especially moral compromise, until the deadly war finally imposed the uncompromising principle of human freedom. General Kelly went on to warn about erasing history, purging from recollection that which does not comport with modern values, which is a legitimate caution, except that removing statues of Confederates does not erase history. It simply purges the landscape of tributes to separatist warriors for slavery that themselves perpetuate a false patriotic counter-narrative to historic evil. But 152 years after the surrender at Appomattox, much of the South continues to embrace that very counter-narrative, that of a noble struggle of honor and self-determination led by heroic figures. Today, that perspective takes the form of what some historians call the cult of the lost cause, an ongoing narrative battle that mythologizes the Civil War by obscuring the most shameful chapter of our nation's history.
This cult had one goal and one goal only, through monuments and through other means, to rewrite history, to hide the truth, which is that the Confederacy was on the wrong side of humanity.
That's New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu speaking last May to mark the removal of four of the city's monuments. After fierce opposition and a multi-year legal battle, New Orleans no longer hosts statues of Confederate President Jefferson Davis, Generals P.G.T. Beauregard, and Robert E. Lee, and an obelisk exalting the Battle of Liberty Place, a historic racist attack. Landrieu described the significance of these monuments in the starkest terms.
These statues are not just stone and metal. They're not just innocent remembrances of a benign history. These monuments celebrate a fictional, sanitized Confederacy, ignoring the death, ignoring the enslavement, ignoring the terror that it actually stood for. And after the Civil War, these monuments were part of that terrorism, as much as burning a cross on someone's lawn. They were erected purposefully to send a strong message to all who walked in the shadows about who was still in charge in this city.
And they didn't yield their ground without a fight.
Protests erupted in New Orleans when the city decided to remove the monuments.
Wearing masks to protect their identities, crews worked through the night to avoid large-scale protests.
Security measures, including bulletproof vests, had to be taken to protect the workers who have received death threats.
Malcolm Suber is a historian and co-founder of Take 'em Down NOLA, a group that aims to sweep New Orleans Confederate memorials into the dustbin of history. When we spoke to him last spring, he told us that their effort is part of a decades-long struggle by the black community to tell a truer story of the city. Suber traces the movement to 1954, when black parents, students, and teachers protested the celebration of John McDonough Day. McDonough is thought to have been the largest slaveholder in antebellum New Orleans and endowed many of the city's public schools, schools that, of course, were segregated.
The little black kids would have to bake in the sun while the white kids were laying flowers on the bust of John McDonough. The black community called a boycott, and it was 100% effective. This was the first public protestation of these white supremacy monuments, and it just snowballed from there.
When Suber moved to New Orleans in 1978, there were dozens of public schools named for slaveholders. Eventually, his group persuaded the school board to allow parents to vote on new names, and his group had another big victory in the 1980s.
We got permission from the highway department to remove the white supremacy monument, and that monument, of course, was the one that commemorated the Battle of Liberty Place, so-called.
Now, that was a brief victory. You got that monument taken down, but then a few years later, the city put it right back up. And then it was finally dismantled again in the latest round of removals. But this wasn't some anodyne monument to the heroism of Confederate troops or leaders, the Battle of Liberty Place was another beast altogether.
So basically, a group called the White League, which was made up of Confederate veterans and the sons and daughters of the rich white slave-owning class in New Orleans, proclaimed themselves openly as a group that was bent upon restoring white supremacy in Louisiana. In September of 1874, they launched a coup d'etat against the government of the state of Louisiana and went into battle against the Metropolitan Police Force, which was an integrated police force, had black and white police officers. 14 years later, in 1871, they decided to dedicate a monument to that event. And in 1905, they added a plaque to that monument. People in the black community have always called that the White Supremacy Monument, and the white people, of course, call it the Battle of Liberty Place Monument.
Over 160-some years, people have come to believe that in building these monuments, they are commemorating something that is not, as you characterize it, you know, white supremacy, but something larger and greater, such as an entire way of life. How have they come to be so deluded about the nature of the Civil War and of slavery?
Well, we, of course, know that the Civil War was fought on behalf of the plantation owners, but it was fought by ordinary white peasants, basically. And so in order to buffer and to explain to people why so much blood was shed in the South during the Civil War, they had to make a myth that what they were fighting for was not, in fact, the enslavement of African people, but it was something had to do with home and self-determination for the South. That myth grew and grew and grew. And it grew in the context that there was no real suppression of the planter class after their rebellion and treason against the United States government. Anywhere else in the world, if you had waged war against the central government, not only would you have been stripped, but many of you would have been executed. The rest of you would have been put in jail, and all of your symbols would have been suppressed. But we had the very opposite of that occurring in the South because, as I always say, we won the battle, but we lost the war. And the war grew up among Southern historians to pretend that the planter class in the South, they were fighting to protect the honor of the South rather than they were fighting to protect their ownership of chattel slaves.
Mayor Landrieu gave a speech on the occasion of having these things torn down that was most eloquent.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the scales fell from anybody's eyes if they said, oh, for goodness sakes, of course, now I understand why these are toxic, not only to black Louisianans, but everybody?
Well, there has not been one member of the white ruling class that has come out in support of taking down these monuments. They are so caught up in the myth of these statues and so protective because it was their family members who paid to put these things up in the first place. And so they see this as part of their heritage, but they are so blinded by white supremacy, their attitude is, we run this city, this is our city, and we do what we want to do, and you just got to grin and bear it.
Now, when the statuary disappeared, it's not as though you and the rest of Take 'em Down NOLA put the mayor on your shoulders and walked through the city shouting for he's a jolly good fellow, hip, hip, hooray. You're not really satisfied with this gesture.
How can you just take down four when we got hundreds of street names, school names, and statuary dedicated to white supremacy and the Confederacy? We're not interested in tokens, and we won't be satisfied until all of those are done away with. This is what I raised with Mitch 2 years ago. I said, listen, if we take down one statue, the rich whites who run the city are going to be pissed. If you take down two, they're going to be pissed. So since they're going to be pissed no matter what you do, go ahead and do the complete job. Let's get this over and get this behind us.
I understand you run tours in New Orleans called Hidden History.
Yes.
What do you show people about the black experience?
Well, we talk about the entire development of the slave trade here. We talk about the contribution of the African people in the building up of the city. The African people were the workforce. They were the carpenters. They were the iron workers. They were the people who did all the cooking and the cleaning. We just are an answer to the other Chamber of Commerce type tour, which talks about the glory of New Orleans as being one of the richest cities in the world during the antebellum period. Their romanticism is about the enslavement of African people, and we talk about the struggle of African people against enslavement and the fight for equality.
When you give this tour, is there one site, one story that you want people to have etched into their memories?
Well, we go to a site on Royal Street, Cafe Maspero. Cafe Maspero used to be called the Slave Exchange. And they have a plaque on the outside of their building that says this was one of the sites where people were sold. When I first moved here in 1978, it was not just called Cafe Maspero. It was called Cafe Maspero Slave Exchange. A white friend of mine invited me to go to lunch there. I said, why in the hell would I want to eat in a place that sold my people that I was on the menu? So that is one of the sites that gives a real example of the kind of narrative that is presented by the ruling class of New Orleans, and we like to talk about that. An interesting thing happened after Katrina. The hotel owners decided that they were going to replace the black hotel workers with Hispanics. And basically the tourists had a fit, because the tourists come to New Orleans to see black people entertaining them, serving them, waiting on them.
Be subservient like in the old days.
Yes. They say, we want to see some Hispanics. We can go to Houston. And in many ways, that reflects the society that has been carved out and built here in New Orleans.
Malcolm, thank you.
No problem. Have a good day.
Malcolm Suber is a historian and co-founder of Take 'Em Down NOLA, which advocates for the removal of Confederate memorials and symbols in the city of New Orleans.
So as monuments to the Confederacy go down, what goes in their place? New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu again from his beach.
Why there are no slave ship monuments, no prominent markers on public land to remember the lynchings or the slave blocks, nothing to remember this long chapter of our lives of pain, of sacrifice, of shame, all of it happening on the soil of New Orleans.
There is an effort already underway to mark what happened to over 4,000 lynching victims between 1877 and 1950, and the message their murders implied to Americans black and white. The Equal Justice Initiative documented those Southern lynchings in a report 2 years ago, and it also has set out to make that history seen. Brian Stevenson is a director of the Equal Justice Initiative and professor of law at NYU School of Law.
Where I live now in Montgomery, Alabama, we have 59 markers and monuments to the Confederacy. 59. You can't go anywhere in this community without encountering a street name or a building or a monument. And I would actually accept if people in the South said, you know what, let's not talk about anything that happened before 1965. It's just too painful. I don't think it would be smart, but I could at least accept it. But we actually love talking about mid-19th century history. We just don't want to talk about slavery. You know, the effort in New Orleans was sparked by the tragic murders of 9 African Americans in Charleston, South Carolina, by a young man who had wrapped himself in the story that there is something noble in this identity of Confederate resistance to integration. The Germans lived through a horrific era where Nazis killed millions of Jewish people. And if they never tried to address the identity created by the horrors of the Holocaust, I don't think we would feel about them the way many of us feel. But because there was a movement to create an identity that says we are struggling to recover from all of that ugliness, we trust them. You contrast that with the American South, and it's the opposite. It's as if we're glorifying and romanticizing the leadership of the Third Reich. I mean, in Alabama, where I live, Confederate Memorial Day is a state holiday. On Martin Luther King Day, it is Martin Luther King / Robert E. Lee Day, and it has an impact.
So let's talk about the design of the Memorial to Peace and Justice that you've planned. It has 800 columns, each representing a county where you've documented lynchings. You also have a separate place with identical columns. Each county will be able to take home as monuments, and you're waiting for them to do so. In Montgomery, there is one along the road. Do you think people will take those monuments?
I do. And I think the conversation that will happen in these communities about whether to take these monuments will be important. And even if the first time that conversation happens, there's no success, I think it's important to talk about history. We've started putting up markers at lynching sites across the region. And I really think it's important. Part of the reason why we're so indifferent to racial bias today, we're so non-responsive to racial inequality, is that because we've kind of created a cultural norm that just, it's just not that big a deal. I mean, we tolerated thousands of people being burned alive in the courthouse square. I mean, thousands of people would come in a carnival atmosphere. And, you know, the children and grandchildren of the people who did that have not been asked to reflect on that, to talk about that, to think about that.
I have to say that I looked at the video on your website of the memorial. This isn't built yet. This is the artist's rendering, but it is almost excruciatingly powerful, even on a little computer screen. The columns are hanging as if from trees.
And we're hoping to open next year. When I go to the Holocaust Memorial, I walk through there, and at the end of that experience, I say, never again. And I think we need to create spaces in this country where we are pushed, encouraged, to commit ourselves to saying never again when it comes to the kind of racial terror that we lived through in the American South throughout the first half of the 20th century. And if we don't create cultural spaces to help us get there, I worry that we won't get there on our own.
That brings us to the Equal Justice Initiative, your organization, and its efforts to tally the number and locations of thousands of lynchings in this country. Now, I think those of us on the coasts and in the Northeast and the Northwest may take some comfort in believing that lynching was exclusively a, you know, Southern thing, but it wasn't, was it?
It was not. On June 13, we'll be actually releasing data on lynchings from states all over the country, in Maryland, in Illinois, in Minnesota, in Ohio, the Midwest and West. There's no place in America where we can claim any kind of sanctuary from the implications of this legacy.
You also have a plan for a museum called From Enslavement to Mass Incarceration. It's
right.
Housed near the site of a slave auction site. The name suggests a continuum.
We want to create a narrative museum. We want people to go on a journey. It will start with the active domestic slave trade. You'll see slave pens. You'll hear the voices of formerly enslaved people presented through these holograms. It'll almost be like ghosts are speaking to you. You'll see the human bodies and structures through sculpture. And we want to talk about the way in which slavery evolved. I don't believe that slavery ended in 1865. The 13th Amendment didn't deal with this problem of white supremacy. It's what created the racial terror that led to lynching. And so you'll move from slavery in our museum to this era of lynchings. And then you'll go from that era into the segregation era. You can't really understand the civil rights movement and these Jim Crow laws without understanding the backstory of slavery and lynching. And we celebrate the civil rights movement without really reflecting on the fact that we didn't deal with this narrative of racial difference, this ideology of white supremacy. So today, we have a very racialized criminal justice system where the Bureau of Justice predicts that 1 in 3 black male babies is expected to go to jail or prison. We see these horrific disparities. So the museum tries to draw this through line so that when you leave, hopefully, you'll be motivated to say, never again. How do I engage with confronting this legacy when it manifests itself in our criminal justice system, in employment settings, in public discourse.
You have this quote about poverty. Say it so I don't mess it up.
I don't believe that the opposite of poverty is wealth. I believe the opposite of poverty is justice.
That's another part of the story. The red lines, all the way through the subprime mortgages, the
Absolutely.
Inability to move from one place to another.
Yeah, most people don't appreciate that as a result of the terrorism that was going on in the Deep South, millions of African Americans fled. That's how these communities in Cleveland and Chicago and Detroit and Oakland and Los Angeles became the communities they are today. The black people in those spaces didn't go there as immigrants. They went there as refugees and exiles from terror. And that exodus carried a very heavy economic burden. And when they got to these communities and they were excluded through redlining, when they were not provided the services that we provided to other immigrant communities, it created this kind of generational poverty, this structural poverty.
Now, the Equal Justice Initiative is based in Montgomery, right?
That's correct.
Just last week, lawmakers in Alabama approved a bill that would, and I quote, prohibit the relocation, removal, alteration, renaming, or other disturbance of any memorial building, memorial street, or monument that has stood on public property for more than 40 years without permission from a new state commission. This is widely seen as a way of protecting Confederate symbols. And the governor even added a provision that schools could change locations and renovate, but they couldn't change their names.
Right.
So that's where you've situated the Equal Justice Initiative.
It is. This bill is absolutely tragic. It is a setback. It is the politics of resistance to the kind of progress that we need to make. We're not trying to punish Montgomery for its history. We're really trying to liberate it. I think many leaders have a hard time saying, I'm wrong. They think that makes you look weak. I actually think when you're able to say, I made a mistake, you can get stronger. And so we've made it clear we're not interested in punishing Montgomery or the American South for this history. We really just want to create a space that's healthier.
And here's where we really differ from Berlin. You have a couple of generations removed from the people who participated in the Holocaust. But here in the U.S., for instance, after the removal of the New Orleans monuments, a Mississippi lawmaker named Carl Oliver posted on Facebook that if the, quote, leadership of Louisiana wants to destroy historical monuments of our history, in all caps, they should be lynched, also in capital letters. He deleted that, but is this too soon?
Well, I think we're long overdue. And there are reasons why we're just getting to this conversation, because, you know, when we're struggling to recover from slavery and you're facing lynching, you can't actually talk about the horrors of slavery. You've got to deal with the horrors of lynching. When you've gotten past public spectacle lynchings, but you're still dealing with disenfranchisement, Jim Crow, and segregation, you can't really talk about the problems of lynching. You're dealing with legalized racial subordination. When you get past that era and you see all of this chronic poverty and you're still dealing with mass incarceration, it's hard to get to the space where you can do the cultural work. But I think the time is now. We don't have the kind of shame that I think we need to have. And some people will hear that and think, well, I don't want to feel shame. But the truth is that you have to. You know, I represent people in criminal cases. And my clients, when they have parolable sentences, go before a parole board, if they don't say, I'm sorry, if they don't express some remorse for the crime for which they have been convicted, the parole board will not let them out. And they won't let them out because they don't trust them to recognize and appreciate the wrongfulness of their conduct. Well, it's the same for a collective community. If we don't acknowledge the horror of slavery and lynching and segregation, it's hard to trust people to be committed to racial equality and fair treatment of everyone. And that's the problem with this legislator's comments. It evokes this kind of absence of shame for what happened. It romanticizes it. He wants to replicate it. And we're not going to be a free country while we believe that we can tolerate that vision of how we relate to one another.
The Southern Poverty Law Center has tallied over 700 monuments to the Confederacy on public lands. this process of taking them down is really just beginning. There's so much resistance. Sometimes it's violent. Where do you think the South goes from here?
You know, what happened in New Orleans is that a group of people actually began to understand the truth behind these statues and monuments and memorials. You know, we talk a lot about truth and reconciliation. You can't have the reconciliation without the truth.
Brian, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Brian Stevenson is the director of the Equal Justice Initiative and professor of law at NYU School of Law, and he's the author of Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption.
Thanks for listening. For more OTM, like us on Facebook, where producers post what they're reading and watching and listening to every day. And subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It will enrich your media diet. And it's funny, too. I can say that because I don't write it. The guy who writes it's funny. His name's Jesse. Good man.